with that, we're going to move to item 8, presentation from Oak Tree. Tim Price, I believe you're going to be introducing this item.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Pleased to be joined today by Howard Marks, the director and co-chairman of Oak Tree. This is part of our series of bringing in some of our asset managers to provide us some additional context leading up to our asset liability study. You'll recall we brought in a gentleman from First Eagle in early March to talk about his views of the marketplace. We've also had generalized views of investing and some larger philosophical issues, and Howard's going to be addressing both how to think about risk in his mindset, as well as how to think about risk as it's manifested in market cycles. Just a little bit of background. Cicera's been invested with Oak Tree since 2009 across 4 different funds. We began engaging with the firm right after the Great Financial Crisis, and we invested in their some of their distressed opportunity funds, as well as a series of opportunistic real estate funds totaling about $235 million in commitments over the years. We've gotten most of that money back at this point, but still have quite a large balance of unrealized gains that we hope to harvest over the next couple of years here. Howard has published pretty extensively. He publishes memos on topics of interest periodically. He's published a number of books, most recently published a book on market cycles. I think you'll notice some similarities between Howard's approach to thinking about risk and his emphasis on not getting forced into liquidity squeezes and not being forced into actions that you don't want to take, and retaining operational flexibility. And a lot of that is mirrored in Cicera's functional approach to portfolio construction, dividing the portfolio into the core functions of long-term investing and short-term funding of benefit payments. I think it's timely to have him with us today, both to remind us that risk is not a single concept to all investors. And partially because of that, we end up with market cycles. And we've certainly all been reminded that cycles remain with us over the past couple of months here. With that, I say, Howard, thanks for joining us today. And I'll pass it off to you to go through your presentation.
Thank you very much, Tim. And thank you for to the board for having me today. Tim, before I start, roughly how much time do I have?
I think we talked about 45 minutes to an hour, but obviously with trustees' questions, it may go a bit longer.
Very good. Okay, that means I can meander a little bit. Well, Tim and I worked together to fashion this presentation out of a few, and I'm very glad to go through it with you. Now let me see. Tim, do you change the slides or do I?
We'll be changing the slides on our end.
Ah, that's great. Okay, so please do. And you see, the title is Mastering the Market Cycle. The important part is getting the odds on your side. There is nothing you can do as an investor which is a sure thing, which is guaranteed to work. There aren't sure things and sure losers. Rather, everything is a matter of probability. And just like at the casino or the horse track, you want to invest when the odds are on your side more and less when the odds are against you. And so a lot of what I'll be talking about today is about knowing the difference. Next slide, please. So as Tim said, I'm going to start off talking about risk. Risk is probably the thing I think about the most. And I find it a fascinating topic. By the way, Tim mentions that I write memos. I've been doing that. I just started my 4th decade, and I wrote one on risk called Risk Revisited Again in 2015. And if you want to read more about the things I talk about, Tim or I will be glad to provide it to you, just like all my memos. They're online and they're free. So the point is, what is risk? And people talk about volatility. I don't think it's volatility. I think that the important risk that matters is the probability of permanent loss, not a fluctuation, a downward fluctuation, but of a permanent loss of money. I think that this is what most people mean when they talk about risk. And I think that this is what people demand compensation for if they're going to bear it. I've never said, and I've never heard anybody say, you know, that that is, I may not buy that security because it may fluctuate in price. They may say, I'm not going to buy that security because I could lose money. Next. There are other forms of risk, as Tim says, many, many of them. Another important risk that people think about less is the risk of missing out. And the point is that nobody wants to lose money, but opportunities that you miss out on also can present a serious performance shortcoming. And the risk of missing opportunities is another important risk. And the truth of the matter is that every investor faces two risks every day. There's the risk of losing money, and there's the risk of missing opportunity. And you can eliminate one or the other. You just can't eliminate them both. And if you eliminate one, that puts you firmly in the crosshairs of the other. So most people balance the two. Most people say, well, I don't want to lose a lot of money, but then again, I don't want to miss all the opportunities, so I'm going to operate in the middle. And a lot of what we're going to talk about today is where in the middle you operate. Next slide, please. Among the many other forms of risk, I want to highlight just one. And in many ways, it's the greatest one. And that's the risk of being forced out at the bottom. Many investors, I must say, especially pension funds, claim to be long-term oriented and thus indifferent to fluctuations. But the truth is that bad enough declines can make them sell because they lose confidence, because they get a margin call, or because of the need to fund real world cash requirements. And I was running the endowment of my alma mater, the University of Pennsylvania, in the first decade of this century. And we saw the TMT bust and the global financial crisis. So I know where I speak, and many universities, rich universities, had to sell assets in a fire sale to fund their cash requirements. As they say, some of the greatest pain in 08 was felt by investors who had overestimated their ability to withstand volatility. So volatility seems like something benign when everything's going well, but in a crunch, it can be a real problem. And thus selling out at the bottom, which is to say, turning a downward fluctuation into a permanent loss and consequently missing out on the subsequent rebound, is the cardinal sin of investing. If you buy too high, you may suffer a decline, but eventually most trend lines run positive. If you sell at the bottom, you fail to miss out on the subsequent rebound. That really is money you'll never make up. Next slide.
Howard, just before we move forward here, could you just reference the slide numbers as you go through this? Because not everybody is seeing the screen here.
Okay, thank you. That's a good reminder, Tim. Okay, so slide four says, still on the subject of what is risk, is that four? Okay, I'm sorry. Slide five, page number four. Getting a little bit philosophical, but I think extremely important to realize is that risk is unquantifiable in advance. If risk is the probability of a loss, then it only exists in the future and it can't be measured. It can be estimated, but not measured. And it's really just a matter of opinion. And a variety of experts, even the people who work for me looking at a given investment, will quantify it differently. One will say, I think we might lose 20% in 6 months. One might say we could be down half in a year. One might say, you know, if we hold the 2 years, there's almost no risk. So I think it's very important to note that risk is unquantifiable. And a lot of formulas and models and optimizers require an input for what the risk will be. But clearly, that is only an opinion. Slide six, please. And when I was writing the memo I spoke to you about, and I wrote that risk is unquantifiable in advance, it dawned on me as I was writing, and that's one of the reasons I write, that risk is also unquantifiable even after the fact. Now, this creates a great challenge because you as trustees have the job of assessing the performance of your staff and of your outside managers, and it should be done in terms of risk-adjusted performance. Not only how much money did they make, but how much risk did they take to get it? And if two people get the same return, they didn't necessarily do the same job, because the one who got the same return but with less risk did a better job. But it's important to know that this also can't be quantified even after the fact. And let's say you buy something for a dollar, and 2 years later you sell it for $10. It may or may not have been risky. Was it a safe investment that was sure to produce a positive outcome, or was it a risky investment where you got lucky? You can't tell merely from the fact that you made or lost money. A losing investment may also not have been risky, but just unlucky. So the bottom line is that it's impossible to quantify risk, even in hindsight. And I think I'll skip the remaining lines, which are unnecessarily detailed. So slide seven, last slide on the subject of risk. Where does risk come from? And there was a great investment philosopher named Peter Bernstein, passed away about 10 years ago. But he wrote some of the best, I would say, investment philosophy. And he said that essentially risk says we don't know what's going to happen. We walk every moment into the unknown. And of course, that's true, as we know about the markets and the economies. And I think that the emergence of the coronavirus is an example that we don't know what's going to happen. Nobody had it on their radar screens except for a couple of big thinkers, but nobody certainly knew it was going to emerge now or in what form. And as Bernstein says, there's a range of outcomes. And we don't know where the actual outcome is going to fall within the range. And often we don't even know what the range is. So we have to understand and embrace our ignorance of the future. And I'm just actually putting the finishing touches on a memo on the subject of uncertainty. But this is a very, very important concept. And nobody can attain certainty with regard to the future. And people who profess certainty with regard to the future are probably quacks. Slide eight. Now I'm going to shift focus from the subject of risk to the subject of cycles. And as Tim said, I wrote a book in called Mastering the Market Cycle a year and a half ago. What is a cycle? It is a pattern of up and down oscillation over time around a midpoint. Slide nine. Sometimes the midpoint is thought of as as stable, like the stock market's normal PE ratio. The PE ratio has averaged 15 or 16 since World War II, and we know that the actual PE of the S&P fluctuates around that norm, and we want to be aware of when it's above average and when it's below the average. Slide 10. Sometimes the midpoint exhibits a secular trend, like the level of the stock market. We know that the stock market appreciates over time, but there's a trend line. And it grows about 6 or 7% a year. When the stock prices get much above that, we want to know. And when they're below that, we want to know that also. Another example is the US GDP grows about 2% a year, sometimes more, sometimes less. Slide 11. And sometimes that midpoint consists of a secular trend that is in itself cyclical, like the progress of a civilization or an economy. And, you know, the point is that economies in the long term, viewed in the decades and centuries, have rise and fall, just like the Roman Empire. So that the underlying trend line governing the economy may have a long-term cycle itself, and then there may be fluctuations around that long-term trend. Slide 12. So moving on, I first said that a cycle is a progression of up and down movements around a circular trend. But that suggests that a progression is where event A is followed by event B. And most people talk about this happens, this happens. The most important thing is to understand that a progression is, it's a progression where event A causes event B. And when you think about a cycle and when you think about current events in the investment environment, it's extremely important to think about the causal relationship between events. And this happened today. What does that imply for tomorrow? Slide 13. So to illustrate that, I'm going to take you through the normal cycle. I happen to have been working in the high yield bond world for the last 42 years, so I've seen several cycles. And there's a cycle through which the issuance of high yield bonds affects the availability of opportunities in distressed debt, which is, of course, is another of our areas. So there is a cycle, and I've observed it, and I've written it down as follows. And when I joined the investment business in high yield bonds in 1978, we had highly skeptical, highly risk-averse investors, and their diligence caused the quantities issued to be limited, and they demanded high quality. Because the quality was high, we had low default rates. Because the default rates were low, that caused investors to become complacent and risk tolerant over time. That's only natural. When the investors are more risk tolerant, that opens the market to increased issuance and reduced quality. When the bonds issued are of lower quality, that issuance eventually is tested by an economic problem, and this leads to increased defaults. And the increased defaults have a chilling effect on the investors, causing them to be risk averse once more. This is a cycle. I've seen it play out 3 or 4 times over my career. But the reason I go through this with you is to say that if you look carefully at the progression as I wrote it down, I did a little trick. In each case, the last words of each line are the first words of the next line. So these events don't merely happen in sequence, but each one causes the next. And I think that this is how cyclical processes are best understood. And page 14 and 15, slides 14, 15, 16, if you'll just flip through those, Tim. 14, you see high quality, low default rates, et cetera. Yes, go right through. 15, 16, 17, 18. And then when you get to the end, you go back to the beginning, 19. It resumes. 20, please. So I'm writing this book. I've been studying cycles for 50 years. I'm writing this book, and I get about 2/3 way through it. I believe in cycles. I've observed them. I've learned from them. I think I've profited from them. And it struck me, why do we have cycles? Why don't things just grow every year at their long-term growth rate? I mentioned earlier that GDP grows about 2% a year on average. So why doesn't it just grow 2% every year? Why sometimes 1 and sometimes 5 and sometimes negative? And the return on the S&P 500 averages about 10% a year. Well, why doesn't it just return 10% every year? And in fact, if you look at the history for this thing that averages 10% a year, it rarely falls between 8 and 12. So the average is not the norm. And most of the time, we have much smaller gains or even losses or much bigger gains. But rarely, as I say, is it between 8 and 12. And the answer why we have why these things behave cyclically is simple, but key. And this is an important thing to note. Most positive trends eventually are carried to excess, and those excesses eventually correct on their own or are corrected. It's as simple as that. So rather than ups and downs, it might be helpful to think in terms of excesses and corrections. Slide 21. And why do trends go to excess? Because of the involvement of people. Economies and markets consist of nothing but people. Physicist Richard Feynman, one of the greatest, said that physics would be much harder if electrons had feelings. That is, we walk into a room and we flip on the light switch, and the lights go on every time. And that's because the electrons flow from the light switch to the light itself. They never forget to move forward. They never go on strike and get depressed. They never go in the reverse direction. They always do what they're told. To oversimplify, economies and markets and companies are made up of feelings. People and people have feelings. And that's why trends are taken to excess. Slide 22. Why do trends go to excess? Here's an example. Positive emotions can cause a management to make decisions that result in overexpansion of factories, workforces, and inventories. And the periods in which those optimistic decisions cause overexpansion are marked by above average growth. That's what gets us above the trend line. Or looking at the market, positive investor psychology causes asset prices to incorporate increasing optimism and thus to grow faster than the assets underlying the fundamentals are growing. Periods of excess appreciation are marked by above average returns, but usually lead to precarious valuations. Slide 23. Now, what happens when the excesses are corrected? Go back to the corporate decision. Rapid expansion can bring manufacturing capacity to a level at which it is excessive. And then, like now, when demand falls short of the expectations on which the expansion was predicated, factories may be shuttered, workers laid off, and inventories wound down. These things contribute to a period of below average growth or, like now, a recession. And looking at the market, if securities appreciate enough and faster than the underlying fundamentals are growing, the prices of assets, even good assets, desirable assets, eventually will reach levels that are extreme and unsustainable. And after a period in which they rise faster than fundamentals, asset prices are brought back into line with underlying value through a period in which they rise slower than fundamentals or they decline. And of course, that's a bear market. Slide 24. Are cycles dependable? Well, Mark Twain said, history does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. In other words, every cycle is different from the others in terms of its length, duration, the amplitude of the fluctuations, the speed of the movements, the power of the movements, and also in the causes and in the effects. And, you know, we're obviously going through an unusual episode today. It's unlike any others, but you'd be amazed at how often I get the question, which of the cycles that you've lived through is this experience the most like? They're all different, but certain underlying themes do recur. As Twain said, history does rhyme. It's the themes that rhyme. Slide 25. So I have noted over the years that the recurring themes behind most market excesses to the upside are an excess of optimism, a dearth of risk aversion, and an excess of capital availability. 26. First, let's talk about optimism. In the ideal, the investment decision maker is objective and rational, like Feynman's dependable electrons. And he makes a rational judgment based on the facts underlying the situation. But the truth is, investors are human. And as such, they swing wildly in terms of psychology or emotion between optimism and pessimism, and fear and greed, and credulousness and skepticism. And assets price, how are assets priced? It's most people think that if fundamentals get better, the price will go up. If fundamentals get worse, the price will go down. The truth is that an asset price is a function of reality, that is to say the fundamentals, but also how that reality is perceived filtered through emotion, psychology, and popularity. So excessively positive perception clearly causes prices to overrate the fundamentals and become excessive. And that's what a bubble is. So in theory, investors are rational and objective, but in reality, the market rarely sticks to that happy medium of wisdom. Slide 27. And in particular, market booms tend to be characterized by tales of unending prosperity and limitless potential that push asset valuations to levels that are above the past norms. But in booms, investors eager to participate in these miracles rationalize their behavior with four dangerous words: it's different this time. In other words, the rules and the norms of the past don't matter. Trees will grow to the sky. History has been suspended. And this current miracle, be it the internet or subprime mortgage or Xerox back in 1968 when I started, is worthy of valuations that generally have ended in tears in the past, because it's different this time. And it's essential that investors keep an eye out for excessive optimism that leads to peak valuations and for excessive negativism that produces bargains. You know, for example, if we go back to 1999, what people said is the internet's going to change the world. Everything's going to be different. And so an internet or e-commerce stock, there's no price too high. And it certainly was true, as we know, that the internet changed the world and that e-commerce would be important. But the people who bought stocks in 99 in those areas on the basis, on the assumption that there's no price too high, generally lost almost all or all of their money. So we have to be careful for excessive optimism. Slide 28. Now let's talk about the second thing on the list, risk aversion. People are supposed to be risk averse, and usually they are, and that's the right thing. What does that mean, risk averse? That means that people fear loss, and that a dollar of loss means more to most people than a dollar of gain. That is to say, what we call their subjective utility function is not constant. People are biased towards fear of loss. People are supposed to, as a result, insist on the possibility of incremental returns, what we call a risk premium, if they're going to accept investments that seem incrementally risky. And if they don't, there's something wrong. That's why we get this chart on the right, where the capital market line slopes up and to the right. That is to say that assets that appear riskier must appear to offer higher potential returns, or nobody else will buy them. And that makes great sense. If I offered you a treasury security yielding 6, or a venture capital fund in which if I do a good job, you'll make 6, I would hope you'll buy the treasury, because most people prefer a certain return than a risky possibility of the same return. So risky securities have to appear to offer higher returns, but of course they don't have to deliver them. Page 29. Now, that's the ideal case, risk aversion. But sometimes when things are going well, enthusiasm is high, recent results have been good, the economic sky is cloudless, investors drop their risk aversion. And since they're less concerned about risk, they fail to insist on adequate risk premiums. And they allow the prices of risky assets to go too high, which brings down the prospective return. When investors forget to insist on adequate risk premiums, they generally won't get them. Risk premiums do not occur naturally. They're only the result of investors' disciplined behavior. So when risk compensation is skimpy, investors should cut their risk. And when people are embracing risk bearing, as they do in heady bullish times, cautious investors like me should reduce the risk in our portfolios. Buffett says, the less prudence with which others conduct their affairs, the greater the prudence with which we must conduct our own affairs. page 30. But at other times, when investors are depressed and when recent results have been poor and trouble seems to loom everywhere, like maybe now, investors' risk aversion becomes exaggerated. When risk aversion is excessive, as depicted in this graph, because the slope of the line is too high, that negativity causes the level of risk compensation to likewise become excessive, and the prices of risk assets may be too low. At such times, most investors boycott the markets, despite the lavish potential return for risk bearing. But when risk compensation is generous, as shown here, investors should increase their risk. So we want to know what's going on in terms of investor attitudes towards risk. And in my book about the market cycles, that's probably the longest and certainly the most important chapter. Slide 31. So the point is that Feynman's electrons, which don't have emotions, act as they should every time. If investors acted that way, they would demand a high risk compensation when risk is high and vice versa. But people with their emotions get excited when things go well, they buy avidly, and they push up asset prices. As at the resulting highs of the market, they buy at the high prevailing prices. They forget to demand adequate risk compensation as a condition for buying, and they fail to sell if compensation is insufficient. In the reverse, when things are going poorly, they smart from the declines, they become depressed, they sell with urgency, and they push prices down. As the cyclical market lows that result, they tend to find even swollen risk compensation inadequate, and thus they rarely buy. So this is another example of why we want to know about attitudes towards risk. Slide 32. Slide 32. So lastly, the third element on the list that vastly influences cycles is the impact of capital availability. The volatile cycles in investor psychology and attitudes toward risk cause the credit window to open wide in good times and slam shut in bad. And this cycle wildly fluctuates and is highly influential. When things are going well, capital is available in vast amounts. And suppliers of capital make generous assumptions in their analysis, give borrowers the benefit of the doubt, cede little risk, and forget to demand return or safety. Since many investors do this at the same time, the competition to make investments or supply capital becomes fierce. Slide 33. The conditions caused by this heated behavior on the part of investors are summed up by the seven words, the worst words in the world: too much money chasing too few deals. Heated bidding in the auction for opportunities to invest and lend prices causes prices of securities to rise, prospective returns to fall, security structures to become weak, and risk to increase. And in an environment like that, capital is available in large amounts, even for companies or deals of questionable worthiness. Any deal can get done, including risky ones. Undeserving companies can get financing and roll over their debts. Easy capital availability is a warning sign. We should be sensitive to capital market conditions and investor attitudes. Slide 34. So I've talked about the elements of optimism, risk aversion, and capital availability. Now I'm going to walk you quickly through a typical cycle. Of course, you know, it's an exaggeration, it's a simplification, but I think it makes clear the message, and I think it's very important. So how does a typical market cycle unfold? Here we are, we're on the way up. We've come off a cyclical low, maybe it was the bursting of a bubble or a collapse in response to a recession. But anyway, things are getting better. The economic fundamentals are improving, earnings are increasing and beating expectations. The media report only good news. Slide 35. And as things are getting better, as a result, expectations on the part of investors rise, their psychology strengthens, people perceive only favorable developments. almost everything can be interpreted favorably or unfavorably. And in these times, people put on favorable interpretations. Capital is readily available, asset prices increase, holders are happy and willing to buy more, non-holders flagellate themselves and capitulate and start to buy, and risk aversion evaporates. What do people say? They say the more risk you take, the more money you make. Risk is my friend, bring it on. That's what happens in good times. Slide 36. And as things go well for long enough, eventually we reach a top. And a top is merely the day that the increases stop. But at the top, please note, asset prices are high, prospective returns are low, and risk is high. This is the time for caution. But of course, most people don't know it's the top. The top is only judged in hindsight. Most people are euphoric, since the top in prices, by definition, coincides with peak psychology. And no one's willing to bear the risk of missing out on further gains. Slide 37. Now we're on the way down. Economic fundamentals are deteriorating, earnings decline, and they fall short of investor expectations. Now the media report only bad news. 38. And as a result, investor expectations decline, investor psychology weakens, people see only undesirable developments, asset prices fall, holders of assets are chagrined and sell, non-holders congratulate themselves on having been so smart and stand pat, and risk aversion grows. Investors now flee from risk. And rather than saying risk is my friend, they say bearing risk is just another way to lose money. I don't care if I ever make a penny in the market again, get me out at any price. It's 39. So now the market continues to a bottom. Here, asset prices are low and prospective returns are high and risk is low. This is the time for an investor to be aggressive. But the truth is most people are scared stiff because of what's going on. No one wants to commit capital under these conditions since prices reach bottom just at the time when people are the most depressed and the most cautious. So I think that's an exaggeration, a simplification, but I think that's a typical cycle. 40. Another way to think about it. How do typical markets cycles unfold? Well, back in the early 70s, I was a member of a group that met for lunch once a month, and somebody gave me a great piece of wisdom, which I've never forgotten. The market, a bull market, operates in three stages. In the first stage, only a few exceptionally far-sighted people conclude that improvement could ever occur. That's a bottom. And at the bottom, as I said, most people are depressed and panicked. And only a few people imagine that things could get better. In the second stage, most people recognize that improvement is actually taking place. But in the third stage, everyone thinks things can only get better forever. And of course, that's just as dangerous as the first stage is excessively pessimistic. Slide 41. That can be summed up in just a few words. What the wise man does in the beginning, the fool does in the end. The person who finds that internet stock or the internet itself first can buy when nobody else appreciates the wonders and get a great bargain and enjoy the ride. But the last person to figure out that the internet is going to change the world buys at highly inflated prices and should be prepared to lose a lot of money. The wise man in the beginning, the fool in the end. And this goes back to what I said earlier, every trend eventually goes to excess. Slide 42. Or as Warren Buffett put it, first the innovator, then the imitator, then the idiot. 43. So in trying to wrap up, as I mentioned, the subtitle of my book is Getting the Odds on Your Side. That's all an investor or a board or a staff can do. Now, I think it's useful to view investing and the market this way, and it's a theme through my book. I hope that it resonates with you. I view the market as a lottery. because of it, the degree of uncertainty. And I view investment performance, the performance that's going to occur, is one lottery ticket, that is the actual outcome, which is drawn from a bowl full of tickets, which is the full range of possible outcomes. Remember what Peter Bernstein said, there's a range of outcomes. We don't know where we're going to come out in the outcomes. That is to say, there's a range of possible market outcomes in the bowl. We don't know which ticket is going to be drawn. You might say by fate or by chance or by a prudent government or by an effective business community and by investors making decisions. What about those tickets in the bowl? Assets that are priced below their intrinsic value are the winning tickets. They are more likely to turn out to be winners. And assets that are priced above their intrinsic value are likely to be losers. Now, which ticket will be chosen from the bowl, that is to say, which outcome occurs, will be influenced by the merits, the fundamentals, and the relationship of price to value, but also to a large extent by swings in emotion and by random events. We never know enough about the future to be sure what the outcome will be, that is, which ticket will be drawn. And you know, this inability to know the future is a recurring theme of mine. As I said, I'm writing a memo on it as we speak. But we can have a sense for when the tickets in the bowl tilt the odds in our favor or when they're against us. What determines the mix of tickets in the bowl, the number, the ratio of winners to losers, and thus the odds of investment success? In large part, I think it's the position of the market in its cycle. 44. When are the odds against you as an investor? What causes losing tickets to predominate in the bowl relative to winners? And the answer is pretty much overpricing and unfortunate cyclical position. So when there's a high level of investor optimism, when investors are spurred on by greed, not fear, when there have been recent market gains, when investors are happy with their gains or jealous of the gains of others, and jealousy is a very powerful force, when there's an unwise level of risk tolerance, and when there's an eagerness to supply capital, the odds are against the investor. And when are these things seen? At cyclical highs. 45. On the other hand, when are the odds in your favor? What causes winning tickets to predominate in the bowl relative to losers? The answer is a lack of optimism, a high level of fear, recent poor market performance, widespread losses, excessive risk aversion, and reluctance to supply capital. And when are these things seen? As cyclical lows. And to me, it's almost mathematical and extremely straightforward. Slide 46. Now, the goal is to get the odds on your side. In recent years, we at Oaktree have felt that the market was high in its cycle, as illustrated here in this scientific diagram. We felt that there was a high level of uncertainty in the world, a low prospective return to most assets, full to high asset prices, and risky behavior on the part of other investors. And we felt that conditions like these make the market vulnerable to a recession or, as we have seen, to an unfavorable exogenous event. And thus, for the last several years, we've been operating according to a mantra, move forward, but with caution. We've been investing. We've been essentially fully invested, but applying a higher degree of caution than even our normal high level. In short, we felt that the game was in the eighth inning, but we and nobody else could see anything that would cause it to come to an end. That was prior to February. Slide 47. Now, even if we know what inning we're in, and we thought we were in the eighth, we never know how many innings there will be in the game. And that's why the question, what inning are we in, is kind of inappropriate. And I believe, as shown in this diagram, that from any point in the cycle, anything can happen in the short run. That is to say, we thought we were above the midpoint of attractiveness, but that is, we thought we were above fair value and you know, normal conditions. But yet, as we know, the market can go further up, go sideways, or turn down from any point in the cycle. If anything can happen from any point in the cycle, does that mean we don't know anything? And the answer is no. Knowing where we stand in the cycle influences the odds that the next move will be up, sideways, or down. And thus, knowing where we stand in the cycle and the odds of success can give you a great advantage in investors' uncertain world. You can't predict what's going to happen, but you can prepare. Clearly, nobody was able to predict that there would be the coronavirus. I certainly didn't. Oak Tree certainly didn't. But we were relatively better prepared for it because our view of the market as being elevated in its cycle had permitted us to take a defensive tone. And thus, applying caution in recent years has helped us in 2020. 48, please, Tim. Now, today, conditions have been corrected to a degree. Certainly, the market's riskiness has been exposed and there's less optimism. Prospective long-term returns are considerably higher in certain asset classes than they were 6 months ago. Asset prices are lower, depending on which asset class you're talking about. And certainly, I would say, risky behavior in certain asset classes has been discouraged, although the Fed and Treasury strewing money about has offset that to some extent. In other words, I believe that the market's cyclical position seems less precarious today than it did 6, 12, 18, 24 months ago. But today we have unprecedented exogenous events and certainly not a normal cycle. Thus, we have to accept that the future is unusually unpredictable these days. Is there a page 49, Tim? Boilerplate, as I expected. So that's the end of the presentation. I've talked about risk. I've talked about the normal pattern of cycles. I've talked about how cyclical thinking, maybe you should go back a slide to 48, how cyclical thinking helped us in recent years, and about how we might think today. I hope that was helpful as Tim and I envisioned, and I look forward to taking your questions.
With that, I'll open it up to the trustees. Any questions or comments?
Can you hear me? Howard, one of the things you talked about in your presentation was investor greed. Would you define that?
Well, the more greedy investors are, the more they will try to take advantage of opportunities to make money, and the more they'll forget about the risk of losing money. And so, you know, the point is that our motivation has to be balanced. We should all be motivated to move forward by the need to make money, and certainly a pension plan like yours has to make money to fulfill its promises, but we should be chastened by the fear of losing money. And our, you know, I use the word greed as shorthand, and it has negative connotations that are not essential, but the point is, when our upside orientation has to be balanced by fear of downside. And when those two considerations are in a healthy balance, then the market can be safe and sane. But if people are greedy and forget about the risk of losing money, it's dangerous. And when people are fearful and forget about the opportunity to lose money, it's usually down in the dumps.
Thank you. Any other questions for Howard? Second here. I'm not hearing any. So with that, I'd like to extend our thanks to you, Howard, for this presentation. Very timely. very appropriate for what we're going through. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. And thanks for the opportunity to be with you today. Bye-bye.
Sure. Thank you.
Relationship we've enjoyed.
Great.
Great. Thank you.